On the 11th of November, 1965, Rhodesia, a British colony in the heart of Africa, proclaimed herself an independent, sovereign state. In so doing, she became only the second country in modern times to have declared independence unilaterally, and the first since the 13 English colonies in America seceded from Great Britain in 1776. Rhodesia's action precipitated an international furor out of all proportion to her importance on the world scene. A matter of months earlier, Rhodesia had been no more than a name to the man in the street in Europe and America. Then this comparatively insignificant country of 4 million people rocketed to universal prominence, yet found herself all but isolated in a hostile world. Let us now turn the clock back to Thursday, November the 11th. At 1:15 p.m. on that momentous day, the streets of Rhodesia's towns and cities were strangely hushed. Lunch hour traffic had come to a standstill. Groups of people, white and black alike, had congregated around radio sets in offices, in restaurants, in cars, and on street corners. The tension was electric as the Prime Minister, the Honorable Ian Douglas Smith, was announced. Listen to him now as history is made.
Your government has issued the following proclamation, which I will read to you. Whereas, in the course of human affairs, history has shown that it may become necessary for a people to resolve the political affiliations which have connected them with another people, and to assume, amongst other nations, the separate and equal status to which they are entitled. And whereas, in such event, a respect for the opinions of mankind requires them to declare to other nations the causes which impel them to assume full responsibility for their own affairs. Now, therefore, we, the government of Rhodesia, do hereby declare that it is an indisputable and accepted historic fact that since 1923, the government of Rhodesia have exercised the powers of self-government and have been responsible for the progress, development, and welfare of their people. That the people of Rhodesia, having demonstrated their loyalty to the Crown and to their kith and kin in the United Kingdom and elsewhere throughout two world wars, and having been prepared to shed their blood and give of their substance in what they believed to be the mutual interests of freedom-loving people, now see all that they have cherished about to be shattered on the rocks of expediency. That the people of Rhodesia have witnessed a process which is destructive of those very precepts upon which civilization in a primitive country has been built. They have seen the principles of Western democracy, responsible government, and moral standards crumble elsewhere. Nevertheless, they have remained steadfast. That the people of Rhodesia fully support the requests of their government for sovereign independence, but have witnessed the consistent refusal of the government of the United Kingdom to accede to their entreaties. That the government of the United Kingdom have thus demonstrated that they are not prepared to grant sovereign independence to Rhodesia on terms acceptable to the people of Rhodesia, thereby persisting and maintaining an unwarrantable jurisdiction over Rhodesia, obstructing laws and treaties with other states and the conduct of affairs with other nations, and refusing assent to laws necessary for the public good. All this to the detriment of the future peace, prosperity, and good government of Rhodesia. That the government of Rhodesia have for a long period, patiently and in good faith, negotiated with the government of the United Kingdom for the removal of the remaining limitations placed upon them and for the grant of sovereign independence. That, in the belief that procrastination and delay strike at and injure the very life of the nation. The government of Rhodesia consider it essential that Rhodesia should attain without delay sovereign independence, the justice of which is beyond question. Now, therefore, we, the government of Rhodesia, in humble submission to Almighty God, who controls the destinies of nations, conscious that the people of Rhodesia have always shown unswerving loyalty and devotion to Her Majesty the Queen, and earnestly praying that we and the people of Rhodesia will not be hindered in our determination to continue exercising our undoubted right to demonstrate the same loyalty and devotion, and seeking to promote the common good so that the dignity and freedom of all men may be assured, do, by this proclamation, adopt, enact, and give to the people of Rhodesia the constitution annexed hereto. God save the Queen.
And so the months of speculation and suspense had ended. The deed had been done. But Rhodesia's decision to go it alone did not take the world completely by surprise. The Rhodesian and British governments had been haggling over mutually acceptable terms for independence since the breakup of the Central African Federation in 1963. Mr. Winston Field's Rhodesian Front Party was voted into power on an independence ticket. Not long afterwards, Mr. Smith took over as Prime Minister, and the pace quickened. Conferences and consultations on the independence question followed one another in rapid succession. The negotiations dragged on for over a year. By the third quarter of 1965, a long wake of discarded promises and compromises, warnings and accusations lay strewn over the political scene. If anything, the gap between the two governments had widened. On October the 1st, Mr. Smith was interviewed on Radio Rhodesia. He commented on the possibility of a UDI, a unilateral declaration of independence.
There are people who tend to say, we are doing pretty well as we are, so why not just continue as we are? Well, I believe that we either go forwards or we go backwards. To maintain the status quo means that we will start drifting. And when you drift at this game, you go backwards, you never go forwards. Surely memories cannot be so short. Let us think back to 1962. This was maintaining the status quo. And to say that we were drifting backwards then is putting it mildly, I would say. People with their money and their confidence, all of these things were roaring out of the country at that time. I am convinced, and I am completely convinced from all the evidence put before me, that we are doing pretty well today, because this government has made it clear that it will only move in one direction, that direction is forward, and that it is not prepared to tolerate any drifting. In any case, we are still negotiating, and I think it should be clear to all that the moment we discard our main weapon of UDI, we have lost these negotiations. So, even if you don't believe in UDI, this is certainly the wrong moment to give up the struggle. And speaking for myself, I have always made it clear that if UDI is the only means of obtaining independence and saving our civilization, then I am in favor of such action. I don't think there can be any doubt in the mind of any fair-thinking man that no country in this world is more deserving of its independence today than Rhodesia, when one looks at our fantastic record. Moreover, the fact that we will be independent completely so, economically as well, unlike so many of these countries to the north of us who have political independence but are tied to Britain's apron strings in nearly every other way. And when one considers that morally we are entitled to this, that we've had promises from Britain, for example, that we went to the Victoria Falls Conference dealing with the dissolution of the Federation, on the clear understanding that they could not proceed without our assistance, and that if we went, as soon as this was over, the Rhodesia's independence would be attended to and would be finalized.
So when one adds up all of these things, it is quite clear that we not only deserve this, but morally Britain is under an obligation to give us our independence. And what do you do when you find yourself in similar circumstances? That the other party to the agreement is unwilling to fulfill their moral obligations, I would say that Rhodesia is morally entitled to take matters into her own hands.
A few days later, Mr. Smith flew to London for what were referred to as final and conclusive talks with the British government. But the talks broke down, and Mr. Smith returned home. On October the 12th, the British Prime Minister, Mr. Harold Wilson, presented his case to the British people in a television broadcast.
I want to remind you of the record of this country over many years, under successive governments of different parties, in leading nations, previously colonies, subject peoples, to self-government and independence. Since the war, successive British governments have given freedom and independence to some 20 countries. Over 700 million people have been enfranchised and put in charge of their own destiny. And this is a record without parallel, without precedent in the whole course of human history. Heaven knows countries gaining their independence have made mistakes. Heaven knows there have been cases of arrogance and oppression and arbitrary rule. But against these disappointments, we have to set achievements such as the creation of the modern Commonwealth. No longer an empire, but a free group of independent nations, the greatest multiracial association in the world.
And he went on to say,
for nearly a year, we have been in discussion with the Rhodesian government, with Mr. Smith, to see if we could work out an agreed basis for independence. And what we've been trying to do is this, to reach an agreed solution on the basis of five principles on which we felt and on which we feel we must insist. First, if we were to break with every previous case and give them independence based on their existing constitution, then we must be sure that there would be guaranteed and unimpeded progress to majority rule. And second, we had to be sure that once they had their independence, no longer subject to the British Parliament, they wouldn't amend their constitution so as to make it even less democratic. Third, we said there must be an immediate improvement in the political status of the 4 million Africans. We didn't say, as in every other case, one man, one vote immediate. But we said there must be an improvement. Fourth, there must be progress towards ending the racial discrimination, which has developed under the laws and the practices of the Rhodesian government. And fifth, we insisted, as our predecessors insisted a year ago, that before we could proceed to recommend Rhodesian independence to Parliament, we must be satisfied that the conditions proposed for independence were acceptable to the people of Rhodesia as a whole.
Mr. Wilson conceded that so far, no basis for agreement between the two governments had been found, and he issued a warning on the consequences of a UDI.
A UDI, a so-called independence illegally taken, could start a chain reaction in Africa of which no one could see the end. Many innocent people, men and women and children of all races, black and white, could lose their lives.
The British Prime Minister concluded with these words.
I know I speak for everyone in these islands, all persons, all our people, when I say to Mr. Smith tonight, Prime Minister, think again.
Mr. Smith was not long in replying to the British Prime Minister's comments. He took him to task on a number of points at a news conference in Salisbury.
Mr. Wilson stated that for over 40 years, we have run our own affairs, our own parliament, made our own internal laws, but always subject to the ultimate authority of the Crown and the British Parliament. This is incorrect. Her Majesty's government relinquished her responsibilities to the people of Rhodesia in 1923. And ever since, until the 1961 constitution was introduced, the government of Rhodesia has been the sole executive authority in and over the internal affairs of Rhodesia, and has been responsible to the exclusion of any other authority for the conduct of its affairs, with one limitation, namely, that any law proposed to be passed by the Rhodesian Parliament, which did not apply equally to the African and the European, had to be reserved for the assent of Her Majesty's government. A little later, he stated that under the 1961 Constitution, some 90,000 European electors were represented by 50 MPs, while perhaps 100,000 Africans qualified for the vote were represented by only 15 MPs. Of course, there are only about 10,000 Africans qualified, and so the representation is actually in favour of the Africans. Then further on, he referred to racial discrimination, which has developed under the laws and practices of the Rhodesian government. I believe it appropriate to point out that the British government has been as much party to this discrimination as has been the Rhodesian government. Indeed, the new 1961 Constitution is riddled with racial discrimination at the instigation of the British government and not of the Rhodesian government. Then again, he expressed the opinion that a UDI may mean that many innocent people could lose their lives. I wish to make it clear that this could never happen as a result of anything done by the Rhodesian government. If British or other outside interferences were to promote this, then the responsibility would rest on their shoulders. Towards the end of his speech, Mr. Wilson claimed that there is an answer, namely, I quote, "We are prepared to go on talking, to examine even now the possibility of coming, at any rate, a little closer together on the issues which still so deeply divide us." However, earlier on, he said, and I quote, "And I have to tell you tonight that after all these months, and after a week of hard, straight talks, we are no nearer agreement than we were a year ago. On every one of the five principles, the disagreement is almost total, absolute." One of the most significant passages is where he says that Britain has given independence to over 700 million people, and that this is a record without parallel in the whole course of human history. But I would ask, what sort of independence is this? Does the British government know that in one case, because of the grant of independence, within a matter of days, 3 million people were massacred, brutally murdered, twice as many as the Commonwealth dead in both world wars? Is this not a record without parallel in the whole course of human history? He concedes that countries gaining their independence have made mistakes. Against these disappointments, Mr. Wilson sets the achievements of, I quote, "a free group of independent nations, the greatest multiracial association in the world." But what does free mean in this context? Admittedly, it means one man, one vote, but it also means one candidate only. What does the greatest multiracial association in the world stand for when Commonwealth nations are openly at war with one another, and while some others are training saboteurs and stabbing in the back their neighboring fellow members? Now let me give you some examples of this wonderful democratic majority rule that Mr. Wilson is so irrevocably committed to. Look at the recent election in Nigeria, where a number of people were killed, houses were burnt, one voter was found with 40 ballot papers in his pocket, both parties claiming victory, and two party leaders proclaiming themselves as prime minister. Look at the totalitarian regime in Ghana with the elimination of a free and impartial judiciary, the Chinese communist takeover in Tanzania, the revolution and massacre in Zanzibar, the war in Cyprus, the suspension of the constitution and the state of emergency in Aden, the recent rift between Malaysia and Pakistan. Are these the examples which the British government holds before us and tells us that we should emulate? Do not a number of these cases which I have referred to produce a record of how enlightened democratic civilizations have been transformed almost overnight into unenlightened totalitarian regimes? And is this not perhaps a record without parallel in the whole course of human history? Now for a few brief moments, let us look at the Rhodesian case. Here we have one of the highest standards of civilization on the African continent, an enlightened democracy where color is no barrier and merit the only criterion, a judiciary the impartiality of which is world-renowned, a standard of living and opportunities for the indigenous African which is not exceeded in any country on the African continent to the north of us. Are these the things for which we stand condemned? A war service, both in 1914 and 39, which was in keeping with that of the other civilized nations of the Commonwealth. They were prepared to use us then, but what do we find now? After 43 years of proving our case, we are told that we cannot be master in our own house. Is it not incredible that the British government has allowed our case to deteriorate into this fantastic position, almost comical if it were not so tragic? I believe I should say to Mr. Wilson, Prime Minister, think again.
Hopes for a negotiated settlement were waning. Mr. Wilson paid his first visit to Africa and Rhodesia in October to assess the situation at first hand. And in a last-minute bid to break the deadlock, he recommended that a royal commission be appointed to examine and report on the entire independence question. Here's Mr. Wilson speaking in Salisbury on October the 29th.
I believe that given time, a short time in my view, the proposed royal commission can hammer out a solution which can lead to a speedy and honourable and acceptable basis for independence, a solution which can take the brakes off Rhodesia's economic progress, a solution which can replace fear by cooperation and trust, and enable Rhodesia to achieve the material and moral greatness to which your natural environment, your national resources, the skill and quality of your people of all races have called you. And let me conclude by saying this. It will be the hope of every single one of your friends in Britain who have watched the events of these past few days with anxious hearts, even heavy hearts, that the wisdom of your political leaders of all races will lead your people under God in hope to the future we all desire for you.
The Rhodesian Prime Minister accepted in principle the appointment of a royal commission, but with reservations.
At government level, the differences are as wide apart and as irreconcilable as ever. There remains one possible chance, this royal commission, Mr. Wilson's very own suggestion, a high-level, independent, impartial body, free from political pressure. The Rhodesian government believe that the commission should commence its task immediately. We now await Mr. Wilson's decision. At his press conference in Salisbury last Saturday morning, Mr. Wilson said, "The door is wide open for agreement." I wonder now if it is his intention to slam it closed again. If so, then the end of the road could be nearer than we think.
On his return to Britain, Mr. Wilson stated in the House of Commons that the British government reserved its position to accept or reject the findings of the proposed Royal Commission. In Mr. Smith's view, this stipulation amounted to a rejection of the terms of reference agreed to in Salisbury. The end of the road had been reached. The Rhodesian cabinet could see no alternative but to take matters into its own hands. Accordingly, independence was declared on November the 11th. Now there was no turning back for Rhodesia. Alone, she would be facing the combined wrath of almost every government in the world.